Hey everybody, it's the Week in the Tackle podcast, the podcast where we get together every like other week, sometimes longer than that, and discuss the previous 3 to 6 weeks that we haven't covered since we recorded a podcast last. I'm Tom Rennie, alongside me is MLS broadcaster and full on dresses like a teenager legend, Brian Dunny Dunseth. How are you, mate? You all right?
I'm good. I'm freezing my tush out here in Salt Lake City. From all of a sudden, we had like crazy snowstorms coming through. So can't feel my back, can't feel my hip. And I'm being told there's about 3 feet on the way in the next week. So specta.
Do you get it where when you have any snow, like a couple of inches of snow, and the city will just shut down?
No.
Nothing moves.
No, not here. No, we know how to deal with it. We throw salt down, everything melts immediately. We don't really worry about the environment and where that melted salt water goes. That's neither here nor there. No, but Salt Lake City, for the most part, outside of people not having the right tires on their cars, there's a ton of accidents because people drive like idiots, but this city really doesn't shut down, even when we get a ton of snow.
We had like a minute amount of snow in central London today. It's going to be a very cold week. I'm in the office in central London about 3 p.m. today, 5 p.m., like start of the rush hour coming out of London. And the very second there was one snowflake of snow falling in London Bridge, people were like, "This, let's get home. Jean, get your coat. Call the kids. Call the nursery. We've got to get home now. It's over. It's over. The trains are going to stop working. The roads are going to close. We are f***ed. It's over. London is closing down." And at 3:05, gone. Everybody is gone.
Really?
Because everyone's like, right, well, that's it. If we don't get home right now, this minute, I live in central London. I'm a tramp. That I live in some sort of doorway. I've now got to sleep in the doorway of Londis because there's no way out of this city. Other supermarkets are available. So I think I owe two. Sorry, Tim. I want to talk to you a bit about the FA Cup, Danny. I want to talk to you a little bit about the FA Cup this weekend. Now, I'm not going to do, well, I might do, my annual diatribe of the fact that unless we, as a football community, and those that run the FA Cup, the FA, proactively make positive changes to safeguard the future of what I still think is a pretty important tournament. If they don't, it'll happen to them without them being able to respond to it. Just look at what's happening to the Carabao Cup. That won't exist in 3 to 5 years. It simply can't exist in its current guise next season because of the increased European games that 7 or 8 Premier League teams are going to be involved in. And without those teams, they don't think they can attract a sponsor. No. Certainly not one as incredible as an energy drink no one has ever drunk whilst paying money for it in their entire lives. So if you can't attract a premier sponsor like that, why try and save the tournament? I don't know. And the reason it's interesting here is that they aren't doing my January idea. Play the entire thing in January. 1st of January, you have the third round. 31st of January, you have the final. We're all focused on it. And every time someone tells me a reason not to do it, it's so bafflingly dumb. It makes me more convinced on a yearly basis we should do it. But this particular year around, third round was this weekend, there are 7 Premier League teams who have gone to replay. That is Nottingham Forest, Luton Town, the Hammers, Wolverhampton Wanderers, Brentford, and there's a couple of others, but 7 of the teams are going to go to a replay. Yeah. Everton, and there's another one I've not got on my list. But
do we say Crystal Palace?
Palace is the other, yes. Yeah. They played Everton. So maybe it's on a different day. It's why it's not on this list. Anyway, all these teams are going to a replay. Now, replays are important, and there'll be a lot of listeners who don't know this, that Bristol City, for example, who were taking West Ham to a replay, their owner came out and said it's fantastic. Because in a replay, we get to have a game we didn't expect and we're going to make 6 figures. So they're going to make a huge amount of money, which is really necessary for their survival, their January transfer window from this game. So there is financial incentive to keep replays. However, at this time, half these teams are meant to be flying to Dubai or Malaga or whatever, Gran Canaria for some warm weather training. And now they can't because in this ridiculous winter break, they keep on trying and failing to deliver because the idea should be, let's have a break in the calendar and no one plays. And instead, they split it across 2 weeks and then rearrange replays for the FA Cup in that slot, which means you can't kind of do the thing you plan to do.
Yeah.
And now all these teams are playing. I mean, in terms of FA Cup replays, trying to make it clear to people listening why they exist and why there's so much reaction to the concept of getting rid of them, but a clear drive from Premier League clubs certainly to not have them. Plus, the Championship teams don't give a toss about the FA Cup. They change everybody. They don't care about a giant killing against Man City. They want promotion and that's it. What do you make to it, the fact we're going to be doing a bunch of replays next week that some are happy about, some aren't happy about, but in the end, it's the consumers that I suppose need to be fulfilled by this, and attendance from certainly Championship clubs is down.
Yeah, I would say that the evolution of the FA Cup because of other competitions has changed dramatically, right? The importance, the prioritization of the FA Cup. While I think Carabao Cup is certainly way underneath FA Cup, because of the creations of all of these other tournaments, the additions, or at least the rewards on the backside of competing in Europa League, qualifying for Champions League, qualifying for Conference League, winning that, qualifying for Europa League. We're prioritizing what's more important. For me, and we just had an interesting thing happen here a couple of weeks ago with US Open Cup and MLS effectively trying to say, hey, we would like to use our MLS Next teams, some of our younger teams within the silo of MLS teams, we would like them to be in the tournament. And there was major, major pushback, and you know, we'll see where that ends up landing. But the reality is, I think for the FA Cup, we've got to figure, we're in a really odd moral high ground place right now for me. Obviously, for gentlemen like yourself, Tom, that is a one club supporting team and understands and has grown up with the history of the FA Cup. From the outside looking in, being an American and watching the FA Cup, it was always, the US Open Cup is the equivalent to the FA Cup. FA Cup is the equivalent to the US Open Cup. The US Open Cup has always been historically really, really important to US soccer, to the US soccer landscape. The FA Cup, the same. But what has happened is, I think, is we've seen kind of the morality shift of what is the magic of winning the Premier League? What is the magic of winning the FA Cup? Where it's shifted is, well, the magic is still there, but financially, what's more important? What is my ultimate goal? And what we're seeing is teams and managers categorizing the most important thing. Is it important to win a trophy? Yeah, it's important to win a trophy, unless you're a Tottenham supporter. But the reality is the FA Cup is a huge trophy. And usually, when we get to the quarterfinals and semifinals, that's when teams go all out. And we're used to see some David and Goliath moments where some of these lesser teams has beaten some of the bigger teams. But I think what we're starting to see is there's a bigger gulf. Unless it's an MLS team to an MLS team, or a clear-cut, identifiable, real threat in the championship versus a watered-down Premier League team, we're not really seeing those huge mismatches. We're not seeing those huge results that are just complete headline shocking across England. We're seeing it with Wrexham beating Shrewsbury Town and League One and League Two and Championship maybe. But I think they're seeing a significant stretch, or at least a significant gap, at least for my eyes. So then we get into, I think, the conversation of how do you categorize what's more important? If you're Thomas Frank right now, you're certainly really pissed off about a replay. But also, because you're not in that comfortable position we usually see them at, where Brentford's mid-table, they're closer to relegation than they are to mid-table. So now you're going to see guys really pissed off and saying, well, I didn't want to play. I don't need another game. We've got to figure out a way to be more solidified in the Premier League. If you're, say, Vincent Kompany, away on the road at Tottenham, maybe that was a free shot. Maybe that was a confidence builder. Maybe it's like, okay, guys, puff your chest, egos, be dicks, go out and play, find that rhythm that we had coming through the championship days, even though things are drastically different with some of the names and the faces. That obviously didn't work. But now, you know, you kind of get into this thing where, to your point, Bristol City, the second game brings in more money. There's no doubt about it. But what if we said the higher ranking team has to go on the road? So even if it's Liverpool against Arsenal, the higher ranking team has to go on the road. If it's Brentford against, insert name here, Barnsley, Brentford has to go to Barnsley. You know, Shrewsbury Town has to go to Wrexham, all of those things. But now if we do it in a business model, a financial model, they're going to say, hold on a second, great idea. But in some instances, if the home team only has a ground that's, say, 15,000 people versus, say, they draw Liverpool and Anfield can draw 60,000 people, that 50-50 revenue split is financially more viable for them to take to be on the road at Anfield, as opposed to creating this unbelievable memory of an FA Cup night at home, which could be a reference point for their supporters till the end of time. So we got to, I think, to take away the idea of the replay, financially, you're taking money out of the pocket, but you're also, you know, you're saving players' legs. We had something with the creation, the evolution of League's Cup, where if you drew the game after 90 minutes, it was straight to penalties. Straight to penalties, somebody won, no added extra time, no overtime. It was straight to pens once that final whistle blew. So there was an immediacy, there was an end result, and it was an excitement, and people moved on. You're like, oh, different? Okay, cool. I kind of like that. So I think there's ways to tweak the mousetrap to make it more successful for the FA Cup and minimize the amount of games. But at the same time, morality again, who are we really trying to minimize games for? Those at the top of the tier that have all the money and the squad depth that nobody underneath them has to compete with? Or are we saying this is just what the future of the game needs right now with the continued evolution and creation of all of these other games that are happening outside of league and cup matches?
I mean, the longer term conversation, the better distribution of wealth is going to keep coming up over and over and over again in football, as it has done many times previously, because until you get better distribution, you are going to get an inequality to such a degree where these leagues are going to eat themselves. And that's kind of the pathway we've been on for a long, long time. But let's just say that we can't get a scenario where either all the big teams, lower ranking teams, play away, or the draw, even if they're at home, the lower ranking team gets all the money, the majority of the purse, certainly if they're not in the same league. Let's just say we can't do that, because in the end, you'd be saying to Arsenal or Liverpool or West Ham or Everton, can you give up some money and play this game of football? Good luck with that conversation.
Yeah.
It's not good. They won't cede a single pound note unless they are told to by regulation. And if that happens, you know, who knows? Is it going to be some sort of protest?
By the way,
are going to get weaker teams?
And that's still happening in the United States. That's been a gripe of, because of the lack of marketing surrounding US Open Cup over the years. And this was something that not only did I won with the Columbus Crew, but I also played as an amateur with Hollywood United, and we went to the Portland Timbers and we knocked the Portland Timbers out of the US Open Cup. And then we subsequently got our asses punched in by Seattle Sounders the next week. But I saw the opportunity.
Pay a lot of money for that in some clubs, by the way.
Yes,
that's a lot of money. That's not easy, that.
It's very
free. You can't
ask
the wife. You've got to ask someone who's not the wife to do that for you.
But it was interesting because I'd been with the New England Revolution back in the late 90s, where we got knocked out by Long Island Rough Riders, the division below us. And the next season, Fernando Clavijo, the head coach of New England Revolution, said, no, not worth it. We're not going to win the trophy. I don't want to be embarrassed the way we were last year, and withdrew us completely from the tournament. Columbus, first soccer-specific stadium in Major League Soccer. Lamar Hunt owned the team. Lamar Hunt, U.S. Open Cup trophy. We gave it to him. He lifted it. It was the first championship in the club history. The amateur side, I remember they were trying, Hollywood United was just, so we were a celebrity team. We go musicians, actors, ex-players. We all go do like celebrity games. But I would also play kind of midweek with the team, and it was like the amateur league. They qualified, they went through, and all of a sudden, hey, congrats, dude, you went through. You're going to play Portland Timbers at Portland. And the club and the players are like, who's buying the tickets? And like, is there per diem? And like, how do we get from the airport to the hotel? Because we weren't renting buses. I mean, literally, we took the train from the Portland airport to the team hotel in the outskirts of Portland, and it was not a great hotel. And, you know, like, so all of us, and by the way, we win, and like the team manager's like, so we have to buy more tickets next week to go to Seattle? And how are we going to get to this hotel? And who's going to buy the food? And so, like, all of a sudden, they're like, what the f-? Sorry, Tim. Like, what are we supposed to do here? Like, wait a minute. Like, we're winning. We're an amateur team. We just knocked out an A-League team. Like, we're going to go beat an MLS team. Like, what are you talking about? And they're like, yeah, no, you got to, you have, congrats. You got to pay your own way. And you're like, financially, how does that make sense? Like, you should be the ones funding us, not us funding the tournament itself. So, yeah, I mean, there's so many variables at play. There really is. And I agree with you. Carabao Cup will be the first to go, but they really have to figure out a way to keep what I think is just such an incredible turn at the FA Cup and what it stood for and what it should maintain to be in the future going forward.
I mean, even if people aren't on board with the full doing the whole thing in January, which they definitely should do, and it's the only way to give this competition relevance moving forward and a slot in the calendar, don't do the third round, then do replays, then do half a Premier League week, then do another half a Premier League week. In that time, also, there's a full Championship, League One, League Two, National League round, then do the fourth round, then do fourth round replays, then do 3 weeks of normal games, then try and do the fifth round, then do two further weeks, then do the quarterfinals, because that, I cannot stress to you, yeah, is fucking stupid. Sorry, Tim. It's incredibly stupid because you lose any focus on this competition. You lose any interest from the neutral on what this competition is. And look, I get that because these games are put on terrestrial Freeview TV, they get decent viewing figures. I think the Arsenal-Liverpool game at the weekend was a record for terrestrial TV non-international football in England. It was like 7.5 to 8 million, you know, incredible numbers. Even Man City Huddersfield did 1.5 million viewers online. So there's appetite for it, but there's so many ways to improve it. And I want to ask you about this winter break and get your view on what this is, because I've been told unofficially this will be the last time they do it.
Mm.
It'll be the last time they do it because it's not worked. They tried to do it pre-COVID. Then obviously COVID happened. It changed the schedule completely. And then there was the World Cup, and then there was the rescheduled European Championship. All this stuff happened and they just couldn't make this date work. For whatever reason, they have not done what every other league that has a winter break has done and just called a weekend off and clear. Instead, there's 5 games 1 week, 5 games the next week. And that's all well and good, I suppose, if you get your 10-day window in the season to give everyone 5 days holiday, 3 days warm weather training, 2 days to get ready for the next game, or however the breakdown is. But because they then couldn't find room for FA Cup replays, the teams you mentioned at the top all now have got to completely change their plans to play a game. So why do you think they have done this winter break in this way, considering that it feels like it was set up to fail?
Mm.
And if it was set up to fail, so they can then say in the future, well, look, we tried it, it didn't work. They haven't really tried it, have they? If you're going to do a proper winter break, there needed to be a 10, 12-day bit where there's literally no football here. And if there's no football here, everyone gets it. And it seems weird to me that they haven't tried to do that.
Well, I mean, listen, I think they've probably done their best to figure out what is an incredibly difficult situation. So trying to be lenient in this conversation. But if you wanted to simplify all of this, kick the Carabao Cup out of the conversation, create that same time slot, use that for the opening rounds of the FA Cup, and then build it where the mousetrap is that you absolutely get either a 10-day break or a full 2-week break somewhere in the midst of January after a really convoluted and difficult Christmas schedule. I mean, all I keep hearing is about player welfare. All I keep hearing about is the mental side and the physical side of the players, what we need to do to make sure that they're healthy, that they're okay. Well, I mean, why are we having so many different competitions that are of obvious, sometimes equal value and some distinctively different value? I know we've had this conversation about Carabao Cup. If you want to keep it, take away all the teams that have qualified for Europe that season. Take them out of that conversation.
But how would they attract Thailand's premier energy drink as a sponsor, Danny?
it'd be a little bit more difficult. But I just, you got to take away the replays. At a bare minimum, the easiest thing to do is take away the replays. At a bare minimum, the easiest thing to do is say, after 90 minutes, you go straight to penalties. It'll be super exciting. And I think that's something that the fans can wrap their heads around. I think they could figure out a way to have an appetite for, as opposed to at the end of 90 minutes, we continue to see managers devaluing the tournament by how they're talking about the tournament, saying, oh God, I do not want to play a replay in the fifth round. Oh my God, this is terrible. By the way, I'm not going to be able to put my feet in the sand and Marbella this weekend because...
But you know, even on that though, the fact they've done the calendar in the way they have, they could have done third round, fourth round, fifth round together, and you've got room for a replay in 3 days' time.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you take the weekends that already exist in the calendar and run them together, you would get it all done in such a way that You might have 2 weeks off plus a winter break after that, and you get 3 to 4 weeks off. You know, that's what you've asked for years, and now you're getting it. And if you get through all of them with replays in all of them, there's actual space in the calendar. Mm. Just like if the third round and fourth round were together, you could have third round Saturday, replays the Wednesday if you wanted replays, then fourth round the Saturday, and then replays in the midweek. And instead, they haven't done that. That feels so basic and deliverable, and yet it's not happened.
Well, what if we just said have the games on Wednesdays? Just flat out say take weekends away from the conversation, that all of these games will be played on Wednesdays. Replays will be played on Wednesdays. Just have it a hard calendar date that no matter what, on and I get they're going to say, well, what about London teams? What about this? What about that? So Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Create the same semblance of a schedule that we see for Champions League and that we see for Europa and Conference League. That could be a way to alleviate the congestion at the weekend, and kind of I would argue simplify the conversation, the narrative.
I want to move on and ask you about the only particularly interesting game I thought of the FA Cup weekend, and that was the Arsenal Liverpool game, and ask you a couple of questions about these two teams. And on Arsenal, we're talking about it on the football show on the Monday on SiriusXM FC. And of course, you know, in a central London office, every radio producer in London is an Arsenal fan. It's the dominant talking point around the water cooler and in the canteen and whatnot on Monday. And there's an old cliche that does the rounds. And there's a great program called The IT Crowd. I don't know if you've ever seen The IT Crowd. But two of the characters have to pretend to be football fans. And to pretend to be football fans, they're given a set of cliched sort of football phrases to say whenever they don't know what to say. They hate football, but this guy's asked them to go to the football. And one of them is, the trouble is with Arsenal, they're always trying to walk it in. And the premise of the episode is that whenever they get into a football conversation, they're like, oh, I don't know. And it can be about like Chelsea. It could be about Abramovich. It could be whatever. And they would always be like, well, the trouble is with Arsenal, they always try and walk it in. And everyone would be like, oh, that's so right. Because you could always start a conversation on it. It's like doing a phone-in topic and you're trying to do get callers. And you say, is there anyone out there who's old and is lonely? Or has anyone out there ever had a parking fine or parking ticket they didn't agree with? And if you do that, you're going to get callers. Mm. It's not apropos of anything, but if you need callers, that's what you say. You get them callers. And in football is, the trouble is with Arsenal, are they always trying to walk it in? Bam, that's an hour. And that used to be true anyway, 15, yeah. 20 years ago in the Arsene Wenger trophy days. Is that true again now with the way Arsenal are playing at the moment?
I can understand the narrative. Listen, I think I saw the statistics since Christmas Day, one goal on 63 shots. That first 45 minutes, I thought they were superb. If it weren't for a Konate tackle, or at least a block shot, Odegaard smacks the post. Reece Nelson had his opportunities. Saka had his opportunities. Dare I say, Kai Havertz had an opportunity in that first 45 minutes. I thought Arsenal were the better team. And then whatever the adjustments were, and I think this is credit to Jurgen Klopp and the continued evolution to what we've seen, because he made three identifiable tactical adjustments against Manchester United in that really disappointing 0-0 draw at home against Anfield, is that depending upon what the game needs, he now has an arsenal of players that he can turn to where he can speed it up, slow it down. He can play Trent internal centrally as opposed to maybe a little bit more wide and supportive. So, like, you can bring on Jota, you can move around Nunez, you can use Gakpo if you need to. Gravenberch can sit here. You know, Szoboszlai can push up there into half spaces and all this stuff. So, I think what we're seeing is two, outside of Manchester City, two of the best teams that pass the eyeball test in terms of football. How you like, if you had no skin in the game, you're like, oh, it's a great game, right? Two teams wide open. And this is part of the evolution, is that I think for Mikel Arteta and this conversation about he needs a striker, he has a striker. His name's Gabby Jesus. The problem is, can Gabby Jesus's body, specifically his knee, hold up for the amount of games that he's going to be called upon? It's pretty evident that Eddie Nketiah is not going to be the guy that can come anywhere close to fulfilling what Arsenal wants out of him. If Eddie Nketiah ends up at Crystal Palace, he'll probably drop 18, 19 goals a year. He'll be the next Patrick Bamford-esque type of former Arsenal player, whatever. It is what it is. No problem. Excellent player. But for what this final phase of play is, 99% of the games that Arsenal is going to come up against, Eddie Nketiah isn't going to be the pick him out, play through him, hold the ball up, knock down headers, all of those things. Gabby Jesus isn't that type of player. And we've seen through Pep Guardiola and Manchester City, historically, you don't need those type of players, but they're certainly beneficial when you have an Erling Haaland type presence because it alleviates even more space for the players underneath. So when we talk about Ivan Toney, I don't think he's the right guy. You talk about maybe a Dusan Vlahovic from Juve. Now we're talking. I think somebody that looks a little bit different. But ultimately, is that the player profile that Mikel Arteta wants and or needs? I don't think Kvyat ever sees another game. I'm surprised that Kieran Tierney doesn't want to come back, but I don't blame him. Real Sociedad's a phenomenal city in San Sebastian. That team's flying right now. And Zinchenko is just not, I don't think, anywhere. If Zinchenko's ego could match the performance that Zinchenko puts in 100% of the time, then he's the right player. You have an unnecessary competition in goal, which isn't a competition, but it's more of a distraction. And then ultimately, when Timber comes back, I think that alleviates a lot of the problems. But again, I look at that bench for Arsenal and I say, outside of Trossard, and it's pretty clear that starting, it's going to be Raya, it's going to be Zinchenko, it's going to be Saliba, it's going to be Gabriel, weak spot, Ben White, it's going to be Declan, most likely it's going to be Kai Havertz instead of Trossard, it's going to be Odegaard, it's going to be Martinelli, it's going to be Jesus, it's going to be Saka. So really, where are your impact players? Where are your guys that you can turn to, look down the bench, and Mikel Arteta can say, he's going to make our team better right now. We're going to go score goals. We're going to shut the game down. I need fresh legs, because with five substitutes, I think they start to look really, really thin. And I don't want to hear anybody complaining about AFCON. I don't want to hear anybody complaining about AFC Asian Cup, because you signed the fucking players. You knew what this season was going to look like. Sorry, Tim. So you don't want to miss, you don't want to have a moan, then don't sign the players that you know specifically aren't going to be available for the better part of a month in January.
I was quite surprised by some of the Arsenal fans that I spoke to of just how much, at the moment at least, it feels like Mikel Arteta is getting a free swing. And they still seem to consider themselves as sort of plucky underdogs. And maybe they are, because the team they're facing is a country, right? You got to get 95 points to be champions now, where really you used to need to get 82 to 85. They've put that extra 10 or 12 points on because they're backed by an unlimited amount of funds from a country. So maybe that's part of it, and maybe that'll be the answer to the question I'm going to ask you. But I was quite surprised that, considering the title was there to be won last season, and, you know, they did biff it right at the end, and then they spent again big in the summer. If you go across the Arteta period in charge, Chelsea and Man City have spent more on players, but those clubs have brought money in for players. Arsenal don't sell anybody right now for any money.
Just Flo, so they're Flo Balogun. They got 40 for Flo, right?
Yes, but that's about it.
I get your point.
Last,
yeah.
Across the Arteta period, City did that this year with Cole Palmer just for a laugh. You think about what they made for someone like Ferran Torres. You know, they're always churning around 2, 3, 4 players. That's not kind of the Arsenal plan. They need 5 more Flo Balogun's. They need to make some money on Reece Nelson and Emile Smith Rowe and those sorts of guys. They're still sort of kicking around. But the reason I'm bringing up this kind of broad point in the money is they do spend a lot of their commercial revenue, which still, a bit like Man United, the growth came at such a moment, the fandom is so broad because of what was achieved by a previous generation. The reason there's so much money to spend at Arsenal is because the Invincibles were incredible. And Thierry Henry was incredible, and Arsene Wenger built this amazing legacy. They aren't spending the money they're making now from their success. They're spending the success of the previous generation. And the commercial growth. And what's interesting about that is that when you spend the third biggest amount of money in English football across a 4 to 5 year period, to then be where you were 15 years ago, battling for fourth with Tottenham, I'm quite surprised there's not a bit more of a clamour. And this might be a good thing, by the way. I'm not just saying it as in, like, you should be doing it, Arsenal fans. I don't know. That's why I find it fascinating. There's not much of a clamour for Arteta's got it wrong. Edu's got it wrong. There's a conversation from outside, from people like us, about, you know, Kai Havertz and should they have done that transfer and could they have spent that money differently and blah, blah, blah. What do you make to the fact that it almost feels a little bit like there's an acceptance that, well, we were ahead of schedule anyway? I mean, the schedule thing is bogus, isn't it? Football is, you renew every 6 months if you're not going the right direction.
Yeah, I would say that right now the only team that's ahead of schedule would be Newcastle United and what Eddie Howe's qualification for Champions League looked like last year. I mean, I have friends that are Arsenal fans that, you know, still when they talk about Mikel Arteta and winning the FA Cup, they're saying how much was that Mikel Arteta and his bounce versus Unai Emery's team and what that group looked like. Mikel Arteta is certainly, alongside Edu, has had a great opportunity to build the squad in the manner in which he wanted to. And I remember one of the things that we were talking about on SiriusXM FC for years was that, is Mikel Arteta prepared to be a manager at the highest level when the insistence upon trying to play the same way Man City plays with the players that Arsenal had in that moment of time was clearly not working? So having your game model and what you see and how you want to play, does that match up with being pragmatic at times and knowing what you have to do with the group of players that you have? I think we've continued to see an evolution of this group. I think he brought in two winners in Zinchenko and Jesus. Absolutely. I think there's no argument about that. Saliba coming back after oddly being on the outside looking in for a couple of years, and everyone was screaming, well, why wouldn't you play him? Why wouldn't you bring him back from loan? Like I said, I'm not sold on Gabriel. I haven't been. I don't think I ever will be. But that's just me as a former center back, certain traits. Ben White is solid. By the way, he looked like a burnt sausage inside of an all-white sleeve on that white jersey the other day. My God, man, lay off the sunbed. Declan Rice certainly makes them better. Odegaard certainly makes them better. The Kai Havertz thing's an interesting one because they pay so much money for him and he's still an enigma. He's a good player. He's an excellent player. But what position is he? And did Arteta think that he could really make him a better player, coach him up into whatever he saw that he thought Kai Havertz could potentially do? Martinelli is a great player. Saka is a great player. Jesus is a great player. But once you get away from that, where's that next level?
Yeah.
And this whole idea about overachieving, I mean, I don't, this has been a slow burn. This has been a slow build within the financial fair play ramifications with Edu. I mean, sporting director of the year, all of these things. Like, no, this isn't short-term success. This has been a couple of years of building into a team. So I certainly don't think they're the underdog. I think that the biggest struggles for Arsenal are going to be themselves. They can compete with any team in the world. They can play, they can move the ball around, ping, they look great. But in those small margins, how do they differentiate themselves from being teams that can take losses to draws, draws to wins? Usually, it's no problem. They can do so. If you look at majority of their games that are really, really close, they're digging out in the last 15 minutes or so, they're digging out wins left, right, and central. So yeah, it's a continued evolution, but you've qualified for round of 16. You're out of FA Cup. You, like 2.5 weeks ago, were within touching distance of a Premier League trophy, or at least top spot in the Premier League. How do you figure out a way to go all in and go all in and find the right player that's the right fit for this group? Or do you say, no, I'm happy with what I got, we're going to roll this, and we look back 4 months from now and say, man, you guys really blew it in that January transfer window. You really had a chance to put yourself over the top.
In the end, I'm not sure they're going to have the money to do anything they might want to do anyway. I'm not sure that player they might be able to bring in to change things is even available. And the jury would be out on Ivan Toney, considering he hasn't played for 8 months. And he gave a really interesting interview with Darren Lewis on Sunday into Monday, saying essentially, I've got no intention of leaving Brentford right now, considering the support they've given me. So what happens there will be interesting. Let me ask you a question about Liverpool briefly. The victors in that game, the top of the Premier League team, the Carabao Cup semi-finalist and the Europa League favourites. No one seems to give a toss, though, which I think is quite interesting. Mm. And I had this conversation earlier today, and I wonder what you think about it. I think we get really bogged down, for obvious reasons, it's an entertainment business, in what a team plays like and how visually enjoyable they are. You know, the eyeball test, as you often put it on the show. And you know, when you watch Man City, for example, they are so visually appealing. Some of the football is so, if not jaw-dropping, then it's so head-scratching. You're like, who ran here and what happened and where did they get to this space and blah, blah, blah. It's a fascinating watch. But I watched sort of Liverpool, and what Jurgen Klopp has done and the way they play, I actually think, and I mentioned this earlier on, and we put this out on the SiriusXM FC Twitter page, which is why I think it's quite interesting, because it's not a fully formed kind of thought yet, which is why I think it'd be interesting to see what you think about it. You know, I think there's been a realization the last 2 to 5 years, maybe, that trying to do the Guardiola thing isn't possible. And that's why things like that brilliant Twitter handle, when playing out from the back goes wrong, is so popular. I love it so much, because everyone has sort of tried to do the Guardiola thing, and there has been a great influence there, but you can't do it unless you have Ruben Dias, John Stones, and these guys.
And Sunderland.
Well, I mean, the Sunderland centre half, poor guy, you know, he's trying to nutmeg Mickey Almiron at 1-0 up. Come on, son. I mean, just, they're all trying to do it. And eventually, I think you can already see that's already started to die out en masse. Some are doing it, but, you know, you can pick out Ipswich and one or two others. But in general, it's kind of two pass and clip now. Jurgen Klopp, I was looking at the Premier League earlier today and thinking about who the kind of successful teams have been this season that maybe we weren't quite expecting. Aston Villa, West Ham, Wolverhampton Wanderers, I put into the list, and Everton. Take away the points deduction, they're on 26 points. That will put them into like 12th or 11th, and everyone thought they'd be bottom of the league. And what they do, similar to Liverpool, is, and this has been the evolution of what Klopp has done, something you alluded to earlier on, they don't play the same as they did 3 years ago. They don't play the same as they did maybe even 18 months ago. And part of that is the Alexander-Arnold evolution. But part of it is they've kind of given up on entertaining you. They're not now interested in how much you love them. They're not trying to score the prettiest goals and China won't get in. What they do is try and go from winning the ball back to having scored in the quickest possible time without pumping it up to a big striker who knocks it down to another, which is the traditional view of us saying it's either counter-attacking or long ball football. But it's very direct and very 40-yard passes on the ground as opposed to in the air. And I just wonder, Danny, your view on the influence of Jurgen Klopp, not only on the league, not only on English football, but also on himself and the way Liverpool play. He has had a really interesting evolution, I think, in the last few years. And maybe that's why we're under-reporting Liverpool's relative success this season, because last time they did this, we all loved them. And now we sort of don't want to watch them because they're ugly. But it's incredibly effective and actually quite thrilling when they win a game like they did at the weekend.
Well, as a Manchester United fan, I'd certainly take Liverpool's style of play over what we've seen from Manchester United this year. So I don't know how ugly it is. Listen, I think there's a couple things, right? Heavy metal football evolved after a couple of seasons because I think he got the base formula of how he wants to play and the ruthless and the cunning ability to be up and over the top in transition play back and forth as quickly as possible. But I think when you talk about Sadio Mane leaving, you talk about Bobby Firmino leaving, you talk about Jordan Henderson leaving, you talk about Fabinho leaving, I think you're talking about four highly influential players with the way that I keep saying their player profile, but basically their body type, how they run, how they play, the engine room, you know, the technical ability, all of those things. It just looks different. And so I think they're deeper and they're stronger than they've been for years. And I don't mean this disrespectfully. I think with what they've done, thankfully, because Saudi Arabia decided to come in and throw some crazy money at Jordan Henderson and Fabinho, and now Jordan Henderson doesn't want to be there. Surprise, surprise. But to bring in Szoboszlai, remember, Thiago's still a part of this group. Gravenberch, to think about what the midfield looks like with Endo, which was obviously the last resort, last minute, comes out of nowhere. McAllister got their business done early. Just the continued kind of evolution of what Gakpo, Nunez, Diaz, what that front three looks like. I think what we see is, depending on who's in the starting 11, in the final phase of play, he has 5 to 6 different options. In the midfield, he's got 5 to 6 different options. with the development of Kwanzaa over these last couple of matches, he's now, with the loss of Matip, he's got three true center backs, four if you add Joe Gomez. I mean, Joe Gomez is playing left back right now because both outside backs are injured. So, yeah, it looks different, but I don't think it's any less effective. I think the hard part for, I think, fans that don't watch Liverpool every single weekend is to, when they do turn in and watch them, they say, still highly effective, still really fun to watch. They create a lot of chances. They're super dangerous. It's just different. And I don't think different's worse. I just think different's different. I think that's where, you know, Klopp and his staff, again, where what I fear as a Man United fan is watching Klopp's ability to rebrand and rebuild this midfield in particular. And from having this group from the summer to now, that they're at the top of the table. And we could talk about City, and we could talk about Arsenal, we could talk about United, we could talk about Chelsea, we could talk about Spurs, everything else that might be going wrong. But what Liverpool's doing is they're hitting these benchmarks. And I think now there's just a lot of self-belief in what this group is capable of doing. And I don't think they fear anybody right now. But we know there's still a lot of the season left. But I agree with you. Two cups, Europa League, absolutely Europa League, I would say heavyweights or...
Big favorites.
And now with where they're at the turn of the new year, there's no reason why we shouldn't be thinking that they are much more inclined to be the ones that are going to push Man City to the distance like they did a few years ago.
And you mentioned Jordan Henderson there. I did want to get your view on the Jordan Henderson story. As we speak, the story goes that Jordan Henderson is desperate to get back to English football and leave Saudi Arabia. Of course, Jordan Henderson, when he left English football, left under a cloud of controversy, the controversy being he'd waded into these social issues of equality and LGBTQ plus rights and all these things, and was an ally to the kind of non-straight white community, right, to try and bring all these kind of stories together and push this fight for equality as a leading captain of Liverpool, and then went to a country, you know, read the reports on the country from Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. And even if you don't kind of fully believe what those great organizations would say, you know, the culture is extremely different, extremely patriarchal, and it's going to be maybe to Western eyes, let's say, uncomfortable, for the want of a better word for it. And he went out there saying things like, I think it's a positive thing, me going to Saudi Arabia. My intention is to improve the social situation and the push for equality in Saudi Arabia, where, of course, he went for as much money as possible. Now, the reason I'm going to give you the shorthand of the story, I'm sure most people listening will know it already, is that he now wants to come back. And there was a great story I heard this morning from our friend Ben Jacobs, who carries the Saudi story a lot, where he said he got out there, got this huge wedge of cash, turned up at this club, and I think he's at Al Etifak, who gives a f***. Sorry, Tim. And he basically said, there's no gym. There's no gym here. It's essentially like a local government-funded couple of weights machines. He thought he was going because he was getting £700,000 a week to a professional football club. No, he's going to something that's just suddenly had an influx of money because the Crown Prince wants it as such for his own personal reasons. And he's sort of going, you've got to build this, you've got to build that. There's no fans in these games. There are some we see with fans all over the place, but you can get them in for a game where Ronaldo's playing. Suddenly it's Al whoever against Al whatever in front of 600 people for a team managed by Steven Gerrard, and nobody wants to be there, and he hates it. And I saw a great tweet, Danny, before I get your view on this, from the Guardian journalist Barney Rone, who is a very, I think I'm fair in saying, quite kind of cynical journalist. And he said, quote, a lot of easy cynicism out there, but if Jordan Henderson is saying he's ready to fix British society, now he's finished with the Gulf region, I, for one, back his mission. Danny, Jordan Henderson wants out and maybe most interestingly wants back. What happens next?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, first off, I would say that whoever the seed planters are for Jordan Henderson and his camp have done a damn good job of immediately pushing the right buttons to make sure that this narrative is out there. when the amount of money started to get thrown around, I think the older established players looked at it and said, "Oof, honey, can we do 2 years? Can we do 2 years? I mean, this is life-changing money." And I think it probably would have been socially not as acceptable, but I think we certainly would have respected Jordan Henderson more had he come out and say, "Guys, listen, $700,000 a week. It's for my kids. It's for my kids' kids. I mean, this is life-changing money. Even though I'm a millionaire, you know, tens of millions of dollars in the bank account, trophies, won virtually everything. Like, what are we doing here? What are we talking about?" And I think that probably would have been digested a little bit better. But listen, egos get involved, and whatever the realistic conversation was between he and Jurgen Klopp kind of made it clear afterwards that when he said something to the effect that, you know, having Jordan around wouldn't necessarily have been the best situation, because even though I told him what his role would have been, he would have wanted to play. Then you get ego involved and you guys got to want to compete and whatever. I think it certainly benefited Liverpool. Due diligence, understanding what you're signing. I mean, even when I went to Sweden, I got on the phone, I got on Google Maps, I had someone do a video, show me what the stadium situation was like, the training facilities were like, the cities. We were, what at the time, whatever, the not the FaceTime, but whatever the video chat was, so I could see the city itself to understand what I was walking into. And still, even then, there was a threat of like, yeah, it looks a little bit different than what it is in real life. But, you know, whatever it is, his family living in Bahrain, him coming across the border, him playing for Al Ettifaq, them only having 7,000 per match in a 30,000-seat stadium, the team obviously struggling, the adaption period, the humidity, the heat, whatever we want to call it, the language, the culture, the religion, the identity, all of those things. It's the conversation that you and I have had. You know, London is different than Newcastle. Mm. Liverpool is different than Los Angeles. I mean, Steven Gerrard and his family couldn't settle in LA. Wayne Rooney and his family couldn't settle in DC. So to think, I mean, and those were quote unquote way easier places to settle into. So are we surprised? I know people said, well, look at Bobby Firmino. Bobby Firmino's dad died while they were in Dubai on a trip, and having his whole family together in Saudi, that changes the dynamic significantly and very, very quickly. So I don't think it's apples to oranges there. But for Jordan Henderson, whatever this looks like, I don't really care. It doesn't really affect me. I'm interested to see what it looks like, but not for his career. I'm more interested to see what this looks like from a Saudi Arabian perspective, because I don't know if you've seen the rumors, but there's rumors that Karim Benzema potentially is being linked to LAFC in Major League Soccer, that Bobby Firmino was just at Anfield watching Liverpool play. Not that he's going back to Liverpool, but that there's a little bit more freedom in the potential movement. If these three players theoretically or physically or absolutely leave, what does this look like for Saudi Arabia? What does this look like for Michael Emanalo and what he's trying to do? How does this change the narrative for even guys like, say, Neymar? And I know Neymar's hurt and injured, but now if he sees these guys get out of their contract, he's already had a couple months over there. What if he doesn't like it? I'm just really intrigued to see when people start having a little bit more regret that turns into the publicity that I need to leave, what this looks like, and then how malicious those behind the scenes at Saudi Arabia choose to become. Because there has been a history, and I think even with Al Nassr, when Cristiano Ronaldo and they were trying to sign new players, that I believe FIFA had some type of mandate that they had frozen any incoming players until Al Nassr paid off all the players that they had owed salaries to, that they had just decided like, no, I'm not paying it. So I'm really, really intrigued to see how this plays off. Not for Jordan Henderson, not for Bobby Firmino. Mm-hmm. I'm intrigued to see where they end up, but more so how this is a giant hit, a la what we saw maybe year two, year three with what the project was over in China.
I mean, I am interested in the Henderson thing. My perspective on that's going to be really interesting, because when he comes back over, and I'm sure he'll sign for Fulham or Wolverhampton Wanderers,
Sunderland?
Or yeah, potentially. If they were up in the Premier League, I think it'd be a shoo-in. But I think you probably end up going somewhere. And his interviews are going to be interesting. I mean, he was getting booed coming on for England because of the perceived hypocrisy, well, the apparent hypocrisy of his previous comments and then where he went. But that's going to be really interesting. And the response to Jordan Henderson is going to be quite interesting. What it means for his England position is going to be quite interesting. But also, I think that it's worth noting that when these players were going to Saudi Arabia, and of course, before we'd looked into it at all, we were just hearing about, you know, at all, we know what Saudi Arabia is and what the country is. But I mean, as a passing reference point, we were all saying, God, give me that money. Of course I'll go. Because, you know, that's the first line you say. What's the money? £700,000 a week. Of course I'd go, right? But then I was told by somebody, and told this a few times now from people over there, when you go, it's not like Dubai. When you go, it's not like you can party in your hotel room at night and you'll get away with it because you're such and such. If you go, you're expected to live the way they want you to live, the way you're supposed to, quote unquote, in that country. It's going to be very different. And if you're Andre Gray, who's out there, who needs the money, who's not made enough money out of football as yet, toe that line, make that money. You know, Andre Gray's career had gone off a cliff and he was skulking around the Championship and League One for an extra payday. And now he can do 2 5-year in Saudi Arabia and actually best be set up. If you're as rich as Jordan Henderson, you might start thinking to yourself, what am I doing here? Or as he might put it, what am I doing here? And at that point, you might come back. Anyway, look, we'll do more on that as the story develops. One final bit, Danny, before we're out of time. And this news, I think, broke after you were on air on Monday. Potentially you were on air, you'll let us know, about Franz Beckenbauer.
We're on air.
Sadly passing away on, over the weekend, confirmed on Monday. I don't know exactly when. Franz Beckenbauer, World Cup winning captain of West Germany in 1974, lifted the trophy again as manager in 1990, nearly 600 games for Bayern Munich, won the German top flight as player and manager for them, Ballon d'Or winner, over 100 caps, and his playing career and coaching career, extraordinary. And I'd love your view on it, on him and his influence. And I was just thinking about playing football at a kind of amateur level in the 1990s. And not knowing who Franz Beckenbauer really was. Like, well, you knew he'd obviously been the West German coach because being in England in 1990 and all that sort of stuff. But in general, you sort of don't know. But I'll never forget being like, let's say like 9 or 10, and I was playing centre-half, and you'd pick the ball up and you'd try and do a pass. And I'll just never forget it because this is the first time I'd ever really thought about it. I picked the ball up as a centre-half and played a pass into midfield, then took the return ball or whatever. And the opposition manager, as one of the other dads, was like, hold on, they've only got Franz f***ing Beckenbauer at the back, right? Just, sorry, Tim. I'll never forget it because it's one of those things that was probably replicated on pitches at all sorts of levels around the country, around the world. And in many ways, you know, we lost a lot of greats in the last, you know, 6 months or so. Pele and, you know, whatever, a lot of incredible names.
Sir Bobby Charlton. 48 hours ago.
It's been just an incredible time for these terrible losses. But that's that little bit, isn't it, where it's so crossover that it's cross-generational. It's a reference point for a style of play, and that's Franz Beckenbauer.
Yeah, so my first... So I'm like you. Obviously, I'm too young to remember Beckenbauer as a player. But I can remember going to, like, Blockbuster Video and finding the VHS tape of like World Soccer Superstars. And Beckenbauer was one of like the first guys. And for me, like when I think about Franz Beckenbauer, it's the all white German kit, long sleeve, captain's armband, black shorts, white socks. And he's got the World Cups on, the Adidas World Cups with the long studs. And being a former center back, and I felt like I was always a good passer of the ball, playing out of the back. I could hit the diagonal, all that stuff. But to see, I never was one of those guys that felt comfortable really driving into the midfield and becoming like a central midfielder, attacking phase of play. Like, dude, slow down. Like, you don't have that in you. So I always knew my role. And obviously, I was acutely aware of Pele, Canalia, Beckenbauer at Cosmos. But again, ahead of my time. When I was 12, it was 1989. So, you know, NASL was done at that point. But I grew up with Clay Coyman. Clay Coyman was my coach. Clay Coyman started the 1994 World Cup against Switzerland in Detroit. He was the first American to captain a club team in Liga MX. He captained Cruz Azul. And so like that was my entry point into Alexi and Marcelo and Tony Meola and all those guys. Now I call teammates and friends and now colleagues and friends and all of this. But when I watched, you know, you'd watch these videos, you're like, oh my God, how's he do that? He's so good. Like, he's so good. He's a leader amongst men, but like technically he's finishing off plays, scoring goals, dribbling, slaloming, doing all that stuff. And we had a guy named Thomas Dooley, a German American who came over and played for the United States. And Thomas Dooley wore the red Puma Kings and he would do the same thing. He'd take off out of the back, dribble through the midfield, all of this stuff. And when I was at Bayer Leverkusen in 98, same idea. At the Bundesliga, there was still, you played three in the back if you had that central midfielder guy. Lothar Matthäus, when he came to Major League Soccer, he was doing the same thing, dribbling out of the back. And you're like, dude, what the hell? We had a guy named Mauricio Wright. He was like the closest version to Beckenbauer and Lothar Matthäus, but he's from Costa Rica. Incredibly talented, glided through the midfield. So I just think the game's different nowadays. We don't have those type of players. We have really good passers, but we don't have guys that could pick the ball up and just dribble through. And maybe the game's changed, but wherever you fall in line with them, from player, manager, executive, all of those things, it can all get convoluted really, really quickly. But if you just focus on the footballer, man, what an unbelievable talent. And thankfully, we've all been blessed with being able to watch him. Specifically now, as soon as he passed and I saw it all come through, I just went straight to YouTube, hit Beckenbauer highlights, and just watching him play, you're just like, God, could you imagine what he could do if he had, if he could play in today's game? And I know the game's differently, but could you imagine what that would look like and how we'd all be fawning him, fawning over him in 2024?
Yeah, sad loss. Franz Beckenbauer sadly passing away. We're out of time for this week's program. There's no Week in the Tackle next week, I know. Last week I was ill.
Who's going on vacation?
I know.
Who's doing it?
I've gone the full Tim Horsey here, and I'm taking a few days off because I was so ill last week. I won't bore you with it too much, but I actually thought, I didn't think I was going to make the beach. But I was 4 days in bed. I was like, oh my God, if I ever get up again, I'll make sure I get to the beach as soon as possible. No show next week. That one is totally my fault. So feel free to take the piss out of me on that one. We are going to be back in a couple of weeks' time. That's Brian Dunseth. I'm Tom Runny. Tim Horsey produced the program. It's Week in the Tackle. If you watch the show on YouTube, subscribe as a podcast. If you're listening as a podcast, you can watch the entire thing on YouTube. We'll see you in a couple of weeks when I've got like... not tan as such, but I might be happy.
Ben White. You're going to look like Ben White.
Ben